The Big Journey from Creation to New Creation. This is a Bible teaching series that will take you all the way through the Bible, from the creation account in Genesis to John's vision of the new creation in the book of Revelation. This series is brought to you by creationtonewcreation.com. In our last talk, we saw Adam and Eve fall to Satan's temptation in the Garden of Eden. They ate the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, which God had forbidden them to do. After they had eaten, Adam and Eve's eyes were opened. They knew that they were naked. They felt exposed and ashamed. A hasty cover-up with fig leaves offered no real relief. When the Holy God approached, Adam and Eve's guilt overwhelmed them. In fear and shame, they fled. Once they would eagerly have anticipated God's presence with them. Now they avoided him. God called to Adam, "Where are you?" God knew where he was, but rather than flushing him out of hiding, God called Adam to him. As Victor Hamilton comments, "He is the good shepherd who seeks for lost sheep." God questioned Adam first. Adam was the first human being, and so, as we saw in a previous talk, he was God's appointed head of the human race. And as humanity's head, God held Adam ultimately responsible for that first sin. Adam said, "I was afraid because I was naked." He was certainly aware of the effects of his sin, but he didn't confess and seek forgiveness. God questioned him further. Adam then tried to justify himself. He shifted the blame to Eve for giving him the fruit. But in so doing, Adam implied that it was God's fault for giving Eve to him in the first place. He said, "The woman whom you gave to be with me." Satan, ever the accuser, had sown his own nature into human hearts. Mankind, created to be God's friend, became his accuser. Our righteous God passed judgment. He cursed Satan, and he pronounced judgment on Eve, and then on Adam. God cursed Satan. What does cursing Satan mean? It means that however hard Satan tries to thwart God's purposes, he cannot ultimately succeed. God condemned the serpent to eat dust, an action that symbolizes grovelling humiliation and total defeat. God said to Satan, "I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and her offspring. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel." There would be battle between Satan and Eve, and between his offspring and hers. But one day a single offspring descended from Eve would defeat Satan and consign him to eternal doom. Adam and Eve's act of rebellion had colossal and devastating consequences for mankind and for this world in all kinds of ways. Firstly, Adam and Eve now possessed a rebellious, self-willed disposition, a disposition that every member of the human race, except Jesus, would share. Nonetheless, mankind still bore God's image. That image was now distorted and dysfunctional, but it wasn't erased. A £10 note may be crumpled and torn, but it still bears its original face value. Likewise, sin has crumpled and torn God's image, but we still possess our original face value. We continue to bear the image and likeness of God. Secondly, when God commanded Adam not to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, he said this, "In the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die." The moment Adam and Eve ate that forbidden fruit, they died. But many years would pass before they died physically, so what did God mean? To answer that question, we need to ask this, what actually happens when someone dies? Their earthly physical body dies and decays, of course, but they themselves don't cease to exist. What happens is this, they lose all contact with this world and enter a new realm unseen to us. All their earthly relationships are broken. They have no further contact with this world. And that's what death really is. Death is a set of broken relationships. Most fundamentally, mankind's relationship with God was broken. We see that immediately. The guilty pair tried to hide from God. On his part, our holy God could have no fellowship with them in that fallen, sinful state, and so he expelled them from his garden. They were now in exile, banished from God's immediate presence. Sin breaks our relationships with other people too. Our most intimate human relationship, the love and trust between husband and wife, is damaged. God told Eve, "Your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you." The word desire suggests that she would try to dominate her husband and resist his headship. On his part, Adam would rule over her. He would exercise leadership in their relationship harshly, rather than in love and self-sacrifice. This would be something she would find hard to bear. Each would strive to control the other. As Vaughan Roberts points out, the battle of the sexes has begun. Sin spoils not only marriage, but every human relationship, between parent and child, brother and sister, between neighbours and between employee and employer. As Sandra Richter observes, self-centeredness and competition are now the relational norms. A healthy relationship at any level is hard to find. The third consequence of sin was this: mankind came under Satan's power. Adam and Eve gave their allegiance to Satan, so God condemned them to be Satan's subjects. Satan became the ruler of this world. Human society came under his control. But God is still Lord. Satan exercises his dominion over this world only through God's express permission and within his limits. Fourthly, that first sin in the garden brought Adam and Eve into bondage to sin. Before they fell, they had no natural urge to sin. They could be tempted, but they need not have sinned. But having sinned once, they, and every member of the human race except Jesus, were tainted by an inward compulsion to sin. People can't help sinning. It's natural to them. Fifthly, sin brought pain. God said to Eve, "I will surely multiply your pain in childbearing. In pain you shall bring forth children." Women would now bear children in pain. That doubtless includes more than the physical pain of childbirth. It surely includes the emotional pain, anxieties, and so often heartbreak that bringing up children, now naturally disobedient because of sin, will bring. Miscarriage and stillbirth, infant and child mortality, and barrenness add their own pain too. So the woman's special role as childbearer is now attended by pain. So is the man's special role as breadwinner. God said to Adam, "Cursed is the ground because of you. In pain you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you, and you shall eat the plants of the field." Adam would endure painful toil, relentless, wearying effort in his battle to subdue the earth. He would now scratch a meagre living from ground that more readily yielded thorns and thistles than crops. And God said to Adam, "By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread." Is this simply the sweat induced by sheer hard labour? Perhaps. But Sandra Richter offers another perspective. This idiom speaks of anxiety, perspiration inducing fear. Humanity will now live their lives with a constant gnawing undercurrent of dread that there will not be enough, that their labour will not meet the need. What if the crop fails, the livestock die, a fire, storm or drought? And alongside that pain is powerlessness. Mankind's task was to make this world a paradise, but our race's depravity, coupled with our impaired mental and physical powers, make us unable to do this. We can't subdue and rule the earth as God intended. Derek Kidner comments, "The nature miracles of Jesus give some idea of the control which man under God might have exercised. But instead, Mankind wages a frustrating, wearisome battle against nature, and through greed, incompetence, and ignorance, the human race ravages and pollutes land, sea, and air. Another consequence of sin is inner turmoil, guilt, and anxiety, and frustration. Above all, the loss of God's presence brings a loneliness and emptiness that no one else and nothing else can fill. And our race is unable to fulfill God's calling, and that brings aimlessness and frustration. People search vainly for purpose and meaning in life. Life becomes, in Shakespeare's words, a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. Sin has damaged our physical bodies too. Genetic degeneration brings inherited diseases and disorders. Our bodies fall prey to infection. Injuries may never heal properly, and all of us are prey to the inevitable aging process that ends in death. The natural world suffers alongside us too. It's hotly debated whether animal death occurred before the fall, but we can be very sure that disease and pain and injury, unnatural death and natural disasters were not part of God's plan for this planet. Nature suffers because of our race's sin. Finally, sin incurs debt. Sin indebts people to God. God intended earth to be his paradise home, but through mankind's sin, it's now the scene of crime and suffering and decay. God intended us, mankind, to be his friends and fellow workers, but now people rebel against him. God has been robbed, just as you and I are robbed when someone else's crime derails our lives and brings loss and sorrow and grief. Our sin has brought loss and sorrow and grief to God. Sin indebts us to God. Sin indebts us to other people too. Our sin spoils other people's lives. A single crime can impact a whole neighbourhood, with consequences the criminal cannot ever hope to put right. Even a single cruel word can devastate a life. Take just one example. In Genesis 4, we read that Cain murdered his brother Abel. But he didn't just murder one man. He brought Abel's entire family line to an end. All the children and grandchildren and their offspring and all that they would collectively have contributed to society was eliminated at a stroke. Cain owed a debt to his family and to God that he could never hope to repay. So sin incurs debt both to God and to other people. Justice requires that this debt should be repaid. These then are the effects of sin. Adam and Eve's act of rebellion unleashed consequences that they were utterly powerless to put right. No purgatory, no penance or recompense, no good works could ever put things right. So what exactly did God need to do to deal with sin and all its consequences? The answer to this question sets the scene for the rest of the Bible story. Firstly, we needed God's forgiveness. We needed to be reconciled to God. But God can't simply just forgive us without dealing with our sin. Why is this? Primarily because of this. Sin is an attack upon the honour of our holy, righteous God, and it's a violation of his creation's moral order. If God failed to deal with sin, he would be acting contrary to his own nature, his love, his holiness, his righteousness, and his integrity, and that is something he can never do. So how could God possibly forgive us and reconcile us to himself, and at the same time remain faithful to his own righteous character? We'll see the answer to this later on our journey through the Bible. Secondly, sin needs more than forgiveness. All the countless and ever-unfolding effects of sin must also somehow be unravelled and put right. Each sinner's debt to God and to other people must be repaid. People's sinful disposition, too, needs to be removed. They need resurrection into a new life of fellowship with God and with other people, a life of purpose and inner peace, a life free from bondage to Satan and sin. We need new bodies, free from disease and death. Creation too needs to be set free from its bondage to decay and become the paradise that God had planned from the beginning. Satan and his evil hosts must be disarmed and defeated and consigned to hell. And finally, Satan must be proved a liar. God had been slandered. When Satan tempted Eve, he insinuated that God couldn't be trusted and that he was keeping blessing back from her. God must bring glory to himself, his goodness, his righteousness, his holiness and love, his integrity and faithfulness must be gloriously displayed for the whole creation to see. After God had pronounced judgment on Adam and Eve, he did something quite remarkable. He clothed them with garments of skins. Adam and Eve had tried to cover their nakedness with leaves, but God chose animal skins instead. This is surely more than an act of tender care. We may assume that, to obtain the skins, an animal had to die. God sacrificed an animal for their sake. Here, at the dawn of history, God is surely pointing out that only a substitutionary death can deal with sin. Before they fell, Adam and Eve were able to eat the fruit of the tree of life. Had they eaten from this tree, instead of from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, God would have given them eternal life. But now Adam and Eve were sinners. Had they eaten from the tree of life in their sinful condition, it would have had the most appalling consequences. They would live forever, but without the gift of God's uncreated eternal life, without fellowship with God. So, without a moment's delay, God drove them out of his garden home and cut off access to the tree of life. This was an act of sheer grace as well as judgment. We humans have never forgotten the Garden of Eden. Deep in our innermost beings, we are homesick. We long to return to paradise. Every good drama has us on the edge of our seats wondering how the story will end. The Bible is the supreme drama. How would God overcome Satan and destroy him and his evil kingdom? How could he deliver mankind from Satan? How could he release us from sin and all its consequences and make us his friends again? How could God create a paradise and live there with mankind for eternity? The rest of the Bible tells us how. It's a story that is, as Dorothy Sayers said, the most exciting drama that ever staggered the imagination of man. And, like every good drama, there's a dramatic and quite unexpected twist in the Bible's plot. Look out for it on our journey. Remember what God said to Satan, "I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and her offspring. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel." There would be battle between Satan and Eve, and between his offspring and hers. But one day, a single offspring descended from Eve would, though suffering fearfully in the process, crush Satan's head and deal with all the consequences of sin. In Vaughan Roberts' words, the rest of the Bible can be seen as a search for the serpent crusher. Daniel calls this descendant of Eve Messiah. The Hebrew word here is Mashiach, meaning anointed one. The picture of the Messiah begins right back here in Genesis 3. It grows stronger and clearer as we travel through the Old Testament. The New Testament reveals who the Messiah is. The Greek translation for the Hebrew word Mashiach is Christos. The Messiah is Jesus Christ. So, from the moment of the fall through century after century, God prepared the stage of history for the coming of the Messiah. After the fall, sin corrupts mankind until all hope seems lost, but not to God. Through the centuries after the fall, God begins unfolding his plan of salvation. We'll see how in our next talk.